It's Horticulture Day. Today we're going to focus on organic gardening with Kathleen Dellett. She's a professor of horticulture at Iowa State University who specializes in organic production. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. The drought was hard on everyone this year. We'll talk about how organic crops fared. We'll also talk about the diversity of organic produce in the state and how producers are responding to growing demand for locally grown food. We'll also get the latest on innovations in no-till organic production. Horticulturist Richard Giron of Iowa State University Extension will also be here. He and Kathleen will answer your questions. Join our conversation after the news. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. Good morning. I'm Charity Nebbe. It's Horticulture Day today, and Richard Giron of Iowa State University Extension Horticulture will be here in a few minutes to answer your questions. But joining me first is Kathleen Dellett. She is a professor of horticulture at Iowa State University. Her specialty is organic production. Hello, Kathleen.
Hi, Charity.
So nice to have you in the studio with me this morning. And we're gonna talk about a lot of things right now, but I want to mention that there is the 12th Annual Iowa Organic Conference is coming up in a few weeks. Can you tell me a little bit about it?
Yes, thanks, Charity. Well, the exciting news is this year it will be in Iowa City. And for the first time ever, we are partnering with the University of Iowa, particularly their Office of Sustainability, and holding it in the Memorial Union on Sunday, November 18th, and all day Monday, November 19th.
Okay, and there's still time to register for that, and you can also find out more about that on our Facebook page. Of course, you can also look for it online. There's a lot of information about it available online. It looks like a great conference. And we've talked a little bit on the show last week. We did a harvest roundup where we talked to farmers around the state. We checked in with Andy Dunham at Grinnell Heritage Farms and talked about how hard the drought was for them. And he had some crops that did well, some crops that did not do well at all. Of course, it was a hard summer for everybody. But in talking to organic farmers around the state, Kathleen, how did people do?
Right. Well, unfortunately, to answer completely honestly, the harvests are still coming in. So I can't tell you what our yields are yet, but the predictions are, just like Andy said, some crops did really well and some, it's very sad. So it depends where you were. For example, just south of here in Crawfordsville, they had, I wouldn't say a lot of rain, but a lot more than we had out in Greenfield in southwest Iowa. So just judging by the size of the ears, and looking at the cornfield, looks like that one's going to come in, I'm guessing, 150 bushels an acre, while out in Greenfield, maybe 100 bushels an acre, because I don't think we had rain. We haven't had rain out there for 3 months.
Wow. And, of course, some fields, some farms, some crops will have irrigation. I suppose that probably made it a great summer if there was irrigation available.
Yeah, it's really, really interesting because in our organic vegetable crops, we had really good yields because of irrigation. We had two sites. One was on drip irrigation. The other was overhead. And just putting on about an inch a week produced really good crops because the disease load was so down because it was dry.
Right.
Normally, that's a concern in organic because you don't have a lot of options. We use resistant varieties and use some other cultural practices. But in general, you're going to be dealing with blight in tomatoes and wilt and squash, and didn't have it that bad this year because it was so dry.
Well, and I suppose if things pollinated okay, I mean, the heat and the sun, that was great for a lot of vegetables, right?
Right, but I'm glad you brought that up about the heat because I thought we were aiming for a bumper crop of organic sweet corn, and it looked really good in the field, but when we went to open it up, we saw some unpollinated kernels. So overall, it was
great.
What
does that look like? What does an unpollinated kernel look like?
A small little nub in there instead of a full filled out kernel. But, I mean, we had enough that we're going to feed hopefully 400 people at the conference with that organic sweet corn that we cut and froze and are bringing to the dining services today.
So we have heard so much about local foods in the last few years, and we know that demand for local food has been outpacing production of local food in Iowa for the last few years. Have you seen a tremendous amount of growth in production of organic food in Iowa?
Overall, there's been an increase in production. To be able to tell you exactly how much it's grown in vegetables and fruits versus grains, I don't have that at the tip of my tongue here, but IDOLS, Maury Wills at IDOLS keeps track of that, and they've definitely seen an increase. We have about 108,000 acres of organic production total in Iowa now, and we're in the top 10 in the number of organic producers in the country, and we're number one in organic hogs, as you can imagine. But vegetables and fruits, yeah, that's, I mean, we're set up to be a corn and bean state, so we don't have the high numbers of organic fruits and vegetables, but it's definitely growing. And people like Andy and Melissa Dunham are leaders, I think, in that movement of getting local organic foods into the system. I was just looking at some statistics online before I came in, the Leopold Center, that Iowans consume $8 billion worth of food, and only 14% is grown here in Iowa. So I know, for example, North Carolina, which has many more fruits and vegetables to begin with, but still, we can use them as an example. They have a 20% campaign where they're trying to get 20% of the food consumed from local producers. And I think they're doing really well and getting near that goal. So I don't know if Iowa can go that high, but, you know, something like 10% would be really great to have that as get more local production and consumption. But Johnson County is one of the leaders. There's a lot going on here that we'll be presenting at the conference. Johnson County Local Food Alliance, Field of Family, Iowa Valley, RC&D, New Pioneer Co-op. These are all initiatives around here that are working to get more folks growing local and selling local.
Are you seeing farmers wanting to change from conventional to organic? Are you running into people who want to make that transition quite a lot?
Yes. I wish I had three people helping me to answer all the questions I get. I just had a farmer yesterday. He's been growing conventional all his life, wants to make the switch to organic. It does take – the learning curve is high. So not to keep plugging the conference, but we will have a session on how to transition, how to get certified at the conference. So he's going to be attending that. And also I'll probably, you know, visit with him for longer to take him through the steps. We have a lot on our webpage that helps people go through the transition, but the main things are lining up your fertility source. You're going to have to find some local source of manure, compost, and also thinking about getting your organic seed. You're going to have to ask for that a lot earlier than what you would for your conventional operation.
Well, and there's a transition period because the land has to be organic for 3 years before it can be certified organic, right?
Exactly.
So do you find that during that transition period, farmers are needing to leave their fields fallow, or are they growing in this transition period and just not having certified crops?
Right. There's two ways to do it. Most people are continuing to grow, especially the grain farmers, because you can sell on the conventional market, and conventional prices are very high. So it's easy to transition now because you're not going to lose. Your yields might go down a little during the transition because your soil needs to build up to higher levels of organic matter and fertility from natural sources. So, but during that transition, those first 2 years, you can sell on the conventional market, get good prices for your corn and beans, and then in the third year, sell to the organic market and reap a higher premium. Right now, it's about three times. The returns are about three times what you get for conventional. So that's for the grain farmers. For veggie farmers, they tend to have more land, or they're thinking about transitioning land that's in pasture or CRP, or, you know, they can wait longer. Maybe they'll put a cover crop on for at least a year before they go right into organic. So you see all different ways to transition. But, yes, you certainly can keep growing your traditional crops during transition and just sell them on the conventional market.
You know, when I go to the farmers market, I see a lot of stalls where people will put up signs that say no spray or pesticide free, that kind of thing, as opposed to having certified organic. Do you think it matters to a small grower whether they're certified organic or whether they're just growing organic and not going through the certification process?
Right. And again, it varies. You know, we salute those folks that are growing without pesticides, and synthetic fertilizers definitely helps the environment. And it's just one more step to become certified organic. A lot of folks don't want to pay the funds. I just paid my certification bill yesterday. We do it just like regular farmers. And
how much does it cost?
Yeah, it was $550, and that was about, I want to say, 30 acres. So when you parse that out over, well, we just got a bid for our organic soybeans for $27 a bushel. So when you parse it out over how much more premium you're going to get for your organic crops, it really doesn't come out to very much. And also, there's cost share that you can get from the Department of Agriculture that will pay up to 75% of your certification fees through Maury Will's office at IDOL. So in the end, it's not really that much higher. Right.
So if you're willing to jump through the hoops.
Exactly. I tell people
it's paperwork.
It's paperwork. It's like filling out taxes. Who likes to do it? None of us. But, boy, I like when they pave the roads and keep the fire trucks running. So you pay for what you get.
Are you seeing new crops being grown in Iowa that we're not familiar with?
Iowans are innovators and experimenters. I really like that about being here. And every once in a while you'll hear somebody's trying kiwi fruit, for example. And I haven't heard anybody doing quinoa yet, but I'm hoping somebody will, because all of a sudden that's hot in the market, which is pretty funny because we've been eating it for 20 years. But it's a fad now. And amaranth is another one that, again, it's been grown here for a long time, but suddenly people are thinking it's a new crop.
Well, and there was a push a couple of years ago to get people to start planting edamame.
Correct.
In the state. Are you seeing more of that?
I did get a call about edamame. I also got one about black beans, turtle beans. And all these can be grown here. It's just, it's hard to transition to something that's I would call it risky, because you know you can grow excellent corn and soybeans, oats, alfalfa is our normal rotation. So switching to turtle beans and edamames are soybean, but then the big constraint there is you need a picker that can pick them when they're in the immature stage. And we did trial a picker from this company called Oxbow, but it's about a $200,000 machine. So, yes, I'd love to have one, but you'd have to have a market set up for it. And, again, that whole marketing aspect, processing, having that all set up. There are people in Iowa that are working on that. There's a whole this used to be called the Green Bean Project out of Greene County, that if people are interested, I could connect them to that area.
Well, we'll talk more throughout the hour, and, of course, we'll be answering your questions. If you want to ask questions about organic gardening, you can feel free to join us. We'll take all of your questions, though. 866-780-9100. Tweet us at IPR Talk. You can also send email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. If you go to our Facebook page, you can find a link to the 12th Annual Iowa Organic Conference, which is coming up in Iowa City on Sunday, November 18th and Monday, November 19th. And there's still time to register for that conference. My guest right now is Iowa State University horticulture professor Kathleen Dellett. Coming up in just a moment, Richard Giron from Iowa State University Extension will be here. This is Talk of Iowa. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. It's Horticulture Day today, and you are welcome to join our conversation with your questions. The number to call is 866-780-9100. You can tweet us at IPR Talk. You can also send email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. And, of course, you can ask questions about your yard, your trees, your garden. We have an organic expert here with us today, Iowa State University professor Kathleen Dellett. And, of course, Richard Giron is here from Iowa State University Extension. Hello, Richard.
Good morning.
Nice to talk to you today. And we will get to the phones. 866-780-9100 is the number to call. Joan is on the line from Carroll. Hi, Joan. Joan, are you there?
Hello.
Hi, what's your question?
Well, I had several questions. One, we cut some limbs off our trees, and their little sprouts are coming out there, and I'm just wondering, when's the best time of the year to trim those off?
Okay. What kind of tree?
Maple.
Okay. A good time to prune a maple tree would be like in March or early April.
Okay.
Before they leaf out.
Uh-huh.
Now, when you do it in late winter, early spring, those pruning cuts will bleed for several days, but it doesn't harm the tree.
Yes. Well, I know they've been under a lot of stress this summer, and I just didn't want to stress them anymore.
And are you saying it's sending up shoots, Joan? Is that your question? Is it sending up shoots around the tree?
Just around where the limbs have been cut.
Oh, okay.
And then I have some boxwood. When's the best time to trim those boxwood?
I would do that probably around mid-April in the Carroll area.
And I have a lily plant that I want to transplant. When should I do that?
You can do that right now or sometime in the next 2 or 3 weeks.
Oh, okay. And some Tony Aster plants, they're in pots. When can I replant those?
Well, you can still plant those if you wish.
Okay.
And if you do, do it as soon as possible. And if
All
you
right.
do, then make sure that you water those on a regular basis until the ground freezes in late November or December.
All right, Joan, thank you so much for your call. And Nathan is on the line next from Muscatine. Hi, Nathan.
How's it going this afternoon?
Good. What would you like to talk about?
I have a question. My son, Simon, joined the 4-H Club last year, and he wanted to do a bucket cap project. While we were talking about this project, he wanted to see about doing an organic project. And now we reached out to a lot of folks and talked to a lot of people in the neighborhood and folks that you would normally speak with, neighbors and so on and so forth, and nobody really had any good resources to guide a 4-H'er who's starting into their 4-H career down the pathway of starting an organic cattle herd, for lack of better terms. And I was wondering if there might be other resources that might be available to Simon as making his decisions about this bucket calf project for the spring, and how he might also bring along the calf that he has now and make her into an organic cow as well.
Well, of course, Kathleen's specialty is in plants, but I bet you can send him in the right direction.
Thanks, Jerry. Thanks, Nathan. That's really encouraging to hear your son's interested in that. Yes, if you go online to the Iowa State homepage, type in the word organic, the first hit will be my webpage, Organic Ag at Iowa State. And in there is, I think it's right on the first page, it'll give you a link to the publication called Organic Agriculture. And that will have a section in there about organic, if you want to raise organic livestock, how to do it. And basically, it involves finding organic feed. Now, pasture that hasn't had any chemicals on it, that will qualify as organic. And there are folks that are doing 100% grass-based diets for livestock, but most people are finishing at least with grain and supplying grain along the way. And the grain has to come from an organic farm, or you can buy it from a feed store that has certified organic feed. That's getting more and more common in the Midwest now.
I think getting access to at least the feed stores in the Muscatine area don't seem to carry much organic, and I think just having an opportunity to know where those feed stores might be and what they might offer, there's not a lot that's easily found on the web, at least from my searching. Maybe right. I'm not searching the right thing, but I think understanding where you can go to get some of those, if I want to buy organic seeds
right.
to feed, where do we go to get them?
Okay,
that sort of stuff.
I could give you a name of a group right around here. It's called Professional Proteins. If you give them a call.
Okay.
I'm pretty sure they're going to be buying our organic corn from Crawfordsville.
Oh, okay.
So maybe you can
okay.
get some of that. That would be great.
It's also helpful sometimes when you can just find the farmer that wants to sell their crop as well.
Exactly. And there are a lot of organic farmers
some
in
of those
the
connections.
Right. A lot of organic farmers in the Kelowna area. So that's the closest I can think of around here. But then the other thing, which you probably aren't going to do anyway, is no hormones, no antibiotics are allowed in organic livestock production. Those are the big three: organic feed, no hormones, no antibiotics.
Okay, Nathan, thank you so much for your call. I hope that helps you get started. And next up, we've got Karen on the line in Carlisle. Hi, Karen.
Hello. Thank you for taking my call. I have a question about houseplants. I had my houseplants outside all summer, and unfortunately, I was not diligent about fertilizing them. I'm bringing them in now. They look kind of sick because they're not green anymore. Wondered if how should I fertilize them now when I bring them in, fertilize them during the winter while I'm wintering them over. What should I do?
Actually, we typically do not fertilize them during the fall and winter months. We typically fertilize houseplants in the spring and summer. And so at this point, I would bring them inside and try to find the best location for them and keep them there, and then give them good, consistent care. And you can begin to maybe fertilize in March of next year.
Okay, and what's the best kind of fertilizer? They have these spikes. Are those good to put in the soil to be slow released, or should I just use a water-based fertilizer?
Yeah, I think the water-soluble products are the easiest.
Okay.
You have a number of products like Miracle-Gro.
Right.
And just use those.
Okay.
Very easy.
All right. All right. Thank you.
All right. Thanks a lot for your call. And next up, we're going to go to Alicia on the line in Ottumwa. Hello, Alicia.
Hi.
Hi. What's your question?
My question is basically, I'm looking for an organic solution to cucumber beetles. I had a really terrible cucumber beetle infestation, so they didn't just eat the squash plants. They were eating all my flowers and everything.
All right. That's it. And you're nodding your head, Kathleen. It looks like you had a cucumber beetle problem, too.
I said there were no diseases, but in its stead came the cucumber beetles in force. What we do primarily is use row covers. I don't know if you're familiar with them, but they're these gauzy, nylon-looking white covers that as soon as the squash plants start flowering, we'll put the row covers over them and leave those on to protect them against the... Actually, I take it back. We put them on before flowering. You can remove them during flowering to allow pollination, but some research has shown you don't even have to do that. You can leave them on during the pollination period, too, and the bees are able to find their way under there, but the cucumber beetles hopefully aren't. There are some organic sprays on the market, too, that we've tested. One is called Pyganic, and nothing in organic will equal conventional chemical sprays, so everybody needs to know that it's not going to give you 100% control ever, but it knocked them back enough that, as a matter of fact, we had another bumper crop, and we're going to serve that at the organic conference coming up here on November 19th. So those two products are row covers, and then if you don't want to use those, although I recommend those because then you won't have to spray anything, you could go with this product called Pyganic.
Pyganic. Okay, and have you ever heard of anyone letting chickens loose in their garden to eat cucumber beetles?
Right. I mean, chickens can eat anything. They eat a lot of insects. Now, the problem with them is they are a pest, too, so they can peck plants and, take down things that you want to grow. I did an experiment with weeder geese once that actually found my young organic broccoli plants to be very tasty, too, and took down the whole experiment.
Geese ate plants.
Exactly. Great entry.
All right, Alicia, thank you so much for your call.
All right, thank you very much.
Good luck. If you have a question for Kathleen Dellett or for Richard Duran, you can give us a call at 866-780-9100. Kathleen is an expert in organic production, so if you have any organic questions, today is your day. But, of course, we'll take all your yard and garden questions as well. 866-780-9100. You can tweet us at IPR Talk. You can also send email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. Jim is on the line in Urbandale. Hi, Jim.
I had a question about tree trimming. If you can't wait until late winter, when's the soonest you can trim hard maple and oak?
Typically with oak, we prefer to prune those in December, January, and February, but you could probably do it as early as maybe mid to late November.
Okay, we haven't had a hard enough freeze to avoid the oak wilt.
Well, the key point there is the insect is probably still around to some extent, but every day that passes, the risk becomes smaller and smaller, and it's basically zero by December.
Okay.
So the longer you can wait, the risk goes down every day.
All right. How long, how late in the season do they keep making food?
As far as the trees are concerned, they're dropping their leaves right now. They're going dormant. And once the ground freezes, they're basically dormant, and they'll resume growth next spring. But as far as pruning trees, late winters are typically a good time. March is a good time. If you don't get it done in March or early April, then I would wait and do it in midsummer. Midsummer actually is a pretty good time for most trees except oak trees. So if you have maple trees, linden trees, crab apples, you could prune those nicely in midsummer.
Okay, very good. Thank you.
All right. Thanks a lot for your call, Jim. And let's get to an email question here. This is for Richard from Larry. He says, I have a honey locust that has shoots growing out of the roots. The roots on which I have seen this happening are about 1 to 2 inches in diameter. The shoots are 10 to 15 feet from the mother tree. Can segments of the roots with the shoots be cut and planted with the likelihood that they would become viable trees?
It's possible, but I don't think I would do that. I have a honey locust that suckers too, and the suckers can come up like 20, 25, 30 feet from the trunk, and they do become annoying, but they are coming up from the roots of the plant. And the possibility is there, if they're coming up from the roots of the plant, the common honey locust has large, very sharp thorns. And if you remove a sucker from a plant, and it does take, that sucker may eventually develop very large, sharp thorns. And you wouldn't want that in your yard. So even if you could do that, I probably wouldn't, because you want a thornless honey locust.
Okay, so it's better to go
just
to...
Just buy one.
Okay. here's a question for Kathleen from Joel. I'm hoping your guest has some suggestions for an organic solution to attacks by stem borers on potato plants and vine borers on squash and cucumber plants.
Another one of our nemeses. Again, those row covers will really help. They keep out, they're attempting to keep out all insects. So that would include the squash vine borer, for example. They are really difficult to control once they get in. There are also pheromone traps that you can establish and set around the perimeter to attract them away from your squash crop. And once they get in, I've seen gardeners actually get in there with an X-Acto knife and open it up and dig out that larvae and mound the soil back around the base of the squash plant, and it continues to grow. I have never been able to do that myself, but that definitely has been, I've seen people say that it works and actually seen their plants after they did that to them. You could also use this natural spray called Dipel, Bacillus thuringiensis. But again, it's really tricky because you have to get it on the plant right when they're chewing, because it's a stomach poison to them, so they need to consume it as they're making their way through into the stem. So row covers are the best option there.
Are there any predators, little predators, that work on that as
That's
well?
That's a good point, because in general, there's at least one beneficial insect or natural enemy for every pest out there. So I can't say off the top of my head what it would be, but there probably is a parasitic wasp, a wasp of some sort that will sting them. So that's another reason why you don't want to spray any kind of spray if you can help it, because you could inadvertently hurt the beneficials too.
Okay. Let's go a last email question here for now. Joel says, I'm hoping you're... Oh, wait, I'm sorry. That was the one we just read. Derek says, I have tiger eye sumac that I have not been able to get into the ground. Is it too late to plant it outside, or should I overwinter it inside?
I would go ahead and plant it as soon as you can. They're kind of hard to winter overwinter like in a garage or a shed. So I'd go ahead and plant it as soon as you can. I'll keep it well watered until the ground freezes, and it should be fine.
All right. Brenda's on the line next at 866-780-9100 from Fort Madison. Hi, Brenda.
Hi, good morning.
Hi, what's your question?
I have a question about my cherry tree. I have a newly planted this year cherry tree, and I was told that rabbits like to eat their bark. Is that true? And if so, what should I do about
yes,
that?
Yes, they do. And so what I would do is get some hardware cloth, which is metal fencing or chicken wire fencing, and put that around the tree itself.
Like and I so did with my blueberry bushes.
And so you need to attach that to some metal posts or whatever. And it should be at least 2 feet high. And you may want to pin the bottom to the ground so they can't get underneath it. And leave that in place until at least April of next spring.
Okay, so it can come off in the summer. Just leave it for till April. Okay.
Right.
And so I can't get, there's nothing like tape that you can wrap around it. You shouldn't do that, then let it breathe.
Well, you have other materials too, but I think chicken wire fencing, hardware cloth are the easiest. They're very effective. And if you use hardware cloth, that also prevents voles, which are mouse-like creatures, from damaging their trunk too. So you get added benefit.
Oh, so it's called hardware cloth.
Hardware cloth, correct.
All righty. Thank you.
All right, Brenda. Thanks a lot for your call. And let's see if we can get one more question in here before the break. Kyle is on the line from Parkersburg.
Hi, Kyle.
Hello.
Hi, what's your question?
I have a fun hobby of growing orchids, and I was wondering about the possibility of using, like, buying an LED light for supplementing, because I have no south-facing window in my house for winter.
Well, actually, most orchids don't need a lot of light, so they don't need direct sun. So if you put them near any type of window, like an east window, a west window, a south window, that should be sufficient light for most of them, as long as they get bright light and they're close to that actual window.
That's interesting. You mentioned LED light, Richard, and I know we usually use fluorescent light for indoor lights. Do you know if LED would work at all?
That I'm not sure. But if I was going to use artificial lighting, I probably would just use fluorescent lights.
Okay, Kyle, thanks a lot for your call. We're going to take a quick break, and then we'll be back to answer more of your questions. You can join the conversation at 866-780-9100. You can tweet us at IPR Talk. You can also send email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. With me today, Richard Giron from Iowa State University Extension Horticulture, and Kathleen Dellett. She's a professor of horticulture at Iowa State University, and she specializes in organic production. This is Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. It's Horticulture Day today, and you are welcome to join our conversation. 866-780-9100 is the number to call. You can tweet us at IPR Talk. You can also send email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. With me today, Richard Giron from Iowa State University Extension, and Kathleen Dellett, who is a professor of horticulture at Iowa State University. She specializes in organic production, so particularly if you have questions about organic gardening, today is the perfect day to make the call. 866-780-9100. You can tweet us at IPR Talk. You can send email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. And we'll go to an email first from Pam in Marion. She says, I'm hoping to plant another apple tree this fall. Do you have a chart or something that would list a good cultivar to plant that would blossom at the same time as the two varieties I currently have, Sweet 16 and Honeycrisp? Also, those two little trees were planted 4 years ago, and we've never seen a blossom on either. Should I be concerned?
Well, typically when you plant a fruit tree like an apple tree, you don't want it to bear fruit for 2 or 3 years, because if it does, it's going to stunt the growth of the tree. So it's actually a good idea that it doesn't. I would expect to see flowering and fruiting probably in 3 to 4 years, possibly 5 years. As far as planting a different variety, there probably shouldn't be any problem, because most varieties will pollinate each other. Now, we do have a publication, Fruit Cultivars for Iowa. In there, we list the cultivars that do well in Iowa, and they can go through that list and see if they find something that they like.
Okay, and she said that both of the trees are about 5 or 6 feet tall now. Mm-hmm. She's wondering if pruning would help the trees start blossoming.
Nope. You want to prune them so they have a nice shape or structure to it, but that's not going to force them to actually bloom. So it just takes some time as far as growing and maturity, because their initial objective is to grow, where they develop some nice roots and leafy branches. And then once they get to a certain age or maturity, then they can be allowed to bear fruit.
All right. Tom is on the line next from Des Moines. Hi, Tom.
Hi there. I had a pretty good sweet potato crop this year, I'm trying to figure out how to best store them. And I was on the internet and I read something about curing them. Could you tell me what that's about? And then if that's not a part of the equation, how do I put them away for the long haul? Thank you.
Right. As far as curing, when you harvest them, if you have a warm, moist environment, you put them there for maybe a week or so, and basically that allows the surface to kind of heal and form dry so it doesn't rot in storage. Once they've been cured, then you put them in a cool, dry place, and ideally the temperature should be around 55 to 60 as far as storage.
Like maybe the garage or something after they're cured. It's kind of hard to find a moist, warm environment. Should I just put them in a plastic bag under a heat lamp or for the curing process?
I think I would probably just bring them inside in the warmest place you have and leave them there for a week or so, and then try to find that cooler location and keep them there.
Thank you very much.
All right, Tom. Thanks a lot for your call. Lou is on the line next from Lake City. Hi, Lou.
Hi. I've got two questions. Can we cold storage tulip bulbs until spring and then plant them?
It's possible, but it's rather difficult to do. There's typically not a good place to put them, and oftentimes they tend to kind of dry out and eventually die. So it's kind of hard to do.
Can you moisten them and keep them in a freezer?
Well, you shouldn't put them in a freezer. If you were to do that, you would put them in an environment where the temperature is just above freezing, somewhere around 35 to 40 degrees.
So if you had an extra refrigerator, you could do that too.
Right. What are you trying to do on those?
We're trying to add to our bed, but we've got it full enough that we need to wait till the plants are up to see where to put them.
Okay. What I would suggest doing instead is actually forcing them, where you pot them up. And this typically would work a lot better, where you pot them up in pots, you water them in, and then you put them in that refrigerator where the temperature is just above freezing. And you can leave them there. You need to leave them there for 12 to 16 weeks. Then you can take them out and actually bring them outside if you wish and put them in the ground, leaving them in that pot, and they'll perform quite nicely.
Okay.
So you can do that. That way they have a chance to develop a good root system so that when they do start growing, they can grow very nicely.
Okay.
The cold temperatures are needed for flower formation, and if you do those two things, you can have a very nice display in the spring.
Sounds good. I have one more question regarding raspberries in an organic bed.
Okay.
They're covered in, we've got a bad infestation of ditch grass. Is there any good way to handle that?
Kathleen? Mm.
Ditch grass? What do you mean?
Can you describe it?
Just the grass that grows in the ditches in Iowa.
As opposed to straw? Is that what you're saying?
Hmm.
Maybe Richard can weigh in on this one.
I don't know an easy way of doing that. I really don't. I'm thinking if there's any type of perennial grass in the area, the best way to deal with that might be to relocate the raspberry plants to a different location.
Okay.
And you could do that early next spring and make sure the new location is weed-free, plant-free, and just dig those up early next spring before they leaf out. When you replant those, cut the canes back to around 6 inches in height. And so if they're a summer-bearing variety, they won't bloom. They won't bear next year, but they should grow nicely. Keep them well watered, and hopefully next year you'll have a crop.
Okay.
All right, could you mulch around the...
Right, that's what I was going to say. We put heavy layers of straw mulch around the raspberries.
Right, and that might kind of hinder the grasses, but if they're really a tenacious perennial grass, they might push their way up through it, so it may not actually get rid of them.
Okay.
All right.
Thank you very much.
Lou, thanks a lot for your call. And Kathleen, I know one of the things that you're going to be talking about at the conference, the organic conference that's coming up in November, are experiments with no-till organic. And we spent a lot of time last week actually talking about cover crops with A.J. Nyer on the show. What are you experimenting with no-till, organic?
Right. I'm glad you brought up cover crops last week, because that's what you start with. You plant a cover crop in the fall, and then in the spring you come in and you crush the cover crop. Now, we have a roller that was designed by Rodale Institute out in Pennsylvania. They actually bought the roller for us, brought it out as part of this grant. But they have free plans online that you can download and build your own. Or I've seen people just pull things out of the boneyard and giant rollers and use those to crush the cover crop, because the idea is to physically crush it and break the storage units in it so that it won't regrow. And once that's crushed, it becomes a mulch and it starts dying. So then it becomes this nice desiccated mulch. And then you go in and transplant your vegetables, which we did this year, or you can just drill your, in this case, soybean crop. And then that comes through that dead mulch, and you hardly ever have to go back in and weed if it works well. So you need a lot of biomass. Jay probably talked about that, how important it is to get a good stand.
Right, so this has to be a dense crop.
Dense, yeah. heavy planting rate, and then making sure that it's completely killed before you would go in and plant your commercial crop. And we've had really good luck in vegetables this year. The squash no-till crop, organic no-till crop, actually had higher yields than the tilled crop, which is the first in this system. We're still tweaking it, but we'll also have Jeff Moyer here from the Rodale Institute talking at the conference, and they've pioneered it, and they've had much better luck. They've had up to, I think their highest was 184 bushels an acre of organic corn growing in this system, and they never weeded, used the cultivator at all during the season by using the system.
Wow, so this is probably something we're going to hear a lot more about in the coming years.
I think so.
All right, let's get back to the phones, and you're welcome to join the conversation. 866-780-9100 is the number to call. You can also send email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. And next up is Ron on the line from Cedar Rapids. Hi, Ron.
Hello.
Hi, what would you like to talk about?
I've read a couple articles recently about growing figs at this latitude, and I was wondering if your guests had any advice on fig cultivars that would overwinter here and produce fruit.
Okay, figs in Iowa.
Yeah, I think it's fairly difficult to do, especially in central Iowa. Possibly in southeast Iowa, it's a possibility. I can't recall the varieties offhand, but there are a couple of fairly hardy varieties. But even so, they can't take below zero temperatures. So if you were to grow them here in central Iowa, I think your best bet would be to have them in a large pot, like a 5 or 10 gallon container, and then bring them inside in the fall, like in mid to late November, and then place them in a cool environment where the temperature might be, let's say, in the 20s or 30s, possibly lower 40s, where the plant would actually stay dormant. And so you'd bring it inside after a hard frost or freeze, put it in that cool location, and then bring it outside in the spring. I think that'd be your best bet if you wanted to have figs in Iowa, especially central Iowa.
Okay.
Sounds good.
Ron, thanks
Thank
a lot
you.
For your call. And next up, we'll go to Darlene on the line in Algona at 866-780-9100. Hello, Darlene.
Yes. I have a question about mums wintering them over. So often, you know, they just do not go through the winter. Sometimes they do.
Right.
Is there a something special we can do to keep those from freezing over the winter, from winter kill?
The first thing is, if you want to establish those in your garden, you want to plant those in the spring. Plant the mums in the spring. Those mums that you buy in the fall that are blooming in pots, when you plant them, no matter what you do, they almost invariably winter kill. They just don't have enough time to get established. So if you want to plant those in the garden, plant them in the spring. Now, sometimes if we have a really difficult winter where we have a lot of freezing and thawing, that can heave mums, the plant, out of the ground.
Yeah.
So if we want to give them a better chance of overwintering, what you need to do is go out there probably around, again, Thanksgiving or a little bit later, and cover the plants with several inches of straw. Don't cut them back. Don't cut them back. Some people do, but don't. Don't cut them back. But go out there and cover them with several inches of straw or pine needles. And what that does is, once it gets cold, really cold, the ground is going to freeze, and you won't have that much freezing and thawing, and therefore it won't push the plants up out of the ground.
Leaves will not work?
Leaves don't work very well because they tend to mat down when they get wet. And if they really mat down heavily, they may actually smother the plants, the mums. So
I
don't
see.
Use leaves. Straw works well. It stays nice and loose and airy. Pine needles work well. You could even use chopped corn stalks if you had it.
Okay.
And leave that in place until probably early April.
I see.
Okay.
All right.
Thanks
well, thank
a lot you for
very
your
much.
Call, Darlene.
Mm-hmm.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
And George is on the line next from Kelowna with a question for Kathleen. Hi, George.
Hi. I am an organic farmer down by Cologne, and I have a question for Kathleen about the no-till operation. Where I run into problems is you cultivate the corn so hard before you put the cover crop on it that it is a difficult operation to go to no-till. I have tried it, but you get such a ridged field out there. What does Rodale do with their cornfield after before they don't till it, right? They just go in and put a cover crop with rye, and then they put the soybeans in, correct?
Right. That's I have never actually seen them do it, so it'd be great if you could come to the conference and talk personally to Jeff Moyer from Rodale. He will give you, and plus in his talk, I'm sure he'll cover that a lot. But my idea is that they do just go in and drill the cover crop in the fall. And so they're drilling it right on the existing cornfield or soybean field. It is a little more difficult to drill into that stubble, as you were saying, but somehow it's being done. So we definitely need to investigate it further if you're having problems with it.
Well, I did it a few years in a row, but what you get is not only the cover crop problem of it growing, because it maybe doesn't all get in the ground where the corn rows were, that makes good soil as heat contact. But also when you go in to drill your beans in, you have the same ridge problem, and trying to get them in there is difficult.
Right. And I want to say we're not opposed to what we call strategic tillage. If it's neat, if actually we did in one site go in and till our no-till system this year because of the weed issues, and planted the cover crop immediately following tillage. So if you feel you can't do that, put the cover crop in without tillage to have that good seed-to-soil contact, as you mentioned, then doing a little bit of strategic tillage, not deep tillage, and then immediately putting the cover crop on, I think will be fine for your system. Even with that system, we've shown that you're increasing your carbon in the soil.
Okay. Well, George, sounds like you're a pioneer. Good luck. Eldon is on the line from Atkins. Hi, Eldon.
Good morning. I certainly enjoy your program, and thanks for accepting my call. I have a couple questions. I have a coffea. It's a what they refer to as a cigarette or cigar flower, which is beautiful right now. Is there any chance I could bring it in the house and have it remain such during the winter?
I can't visualize that plant at this point, so I'm not sure.
It's got a long tubular flower, and okay, at the very end it has a kind of a gray. It looks almost like a lit or like a firecracker almost, a ladyfinger, which, in my remote past I used to explode.
Okay. Well, that is a houseplant in many cases, so I'm not sure what species you have, but there is a houseplant that does actually perform quite well indoors.
Okay. It's Ignea. Ignea, and it's a terrific plant for, around the patio or whatever in pots. And next question, if I may, is our geraniums. We had good luck last year. We just did it on a limited basis. When would be the best time to dig those and bring them in or put them in a garage?
Okay, I would do that as soon as possible. You want to do that before a hard frost or freeze. And you basically have three ways to overwinter those. You could simply dig them up and put them in pots, bring them inside, treat them as a houseplant, put them in a sunny window. You can also dig them up and shake off the dirt, and then place one or two in a large paper sack, and then put them in a cool, dry place where the temperature is around 45 to 50 degrees. You can also take cuttings.
Okay, Eldon, thanks a lot for your call. Richard Giron, thank you very much.
You're welcome.
Richard Giron, Iowa State University Extension Horticulture. Kathleen Dellett, thank you.
You're welcome, Charity. Thank you for having me.
Kathleen Dellett, a professor of horticulture at Iowa State University. And again, if you'd like more information about the 12th Annual Iowa Organic Conference, you can go to our Facebook page, Iowa Public Radio. Talk of Iowa is produced by Dennis Reese and Emily Woodbury. Our executive producer is Catherine Perkins. Production assistance from Allison Sullivan. Technical support from Garrett Van Leeuwen. I'm Charity Nebbe. This is Talk of Iowa.